of Kimberly Ann Sharp versus Commonwealth, Mr. Ritter and Mr. Campbell.
Good morning. I would like to reserve 2 minutes of rebuttal, if I might.
Thank you, counsel.
And may it please the court, my name is Todd Ritter. I represent the appellant, Kimberly Sharp, who is on appeal from her conviction in the Chesterfield Circuit Court for the fraudulent conversion of leased property. We have assigned two assignments of error. The first deals with whether or not the particular agreement that Ms. Sharp entered into with an affiliate of Rent-A-Center was even subject to the statute in question under which she was convicted. The second assignment of error deals with her claim that the evidence was insufficient to establish the required intent to defraud, which is also a requirement of 18.2-118. With respect to the first issue, it is unquestionable today that her conduct, if it occurred today, would not be subject to the statute. That was a change in legislation where the Virginia General Assembly made it abundantly clear, very explicit, that the lease purchase agreement that she had entered into was not subject to this statute.
But as odd as it is, doesn't that actually hurt you here? Because we have to presume that by adding that, the General Assembly intended to effectuate a change in the statute.
Well, it could. And I indicated in brief, the question was, did the legislature act too late to save someone like Ms. Sharp,
who was... And don't the cases stand for the proposition that unless we have good evidence otherwise, a legislative amendment is intended to change the statute?
Or to clarify the statute. Our position is, I think it must be, is that what the legislature intended to do was to make very clear that this type of agreement was not subject to the statute because it could potentially catch up someone in a broad net, as it did Ms. Sharp, and criminalize what is really a normal event in debtor-creditor relations.
Counsel, for purposes of statutory interpretation, we only go that route in looking at it in terms of a correction or clarification when the language is unclear, correct? When
yes,
the language
sir.
In the statute is unclear and the legislative intent is unclear.
I would suggest, however, there's an overview, and the principles are certainly beyond dispute, that the court must interpret a criminal statute strictly against the Commonwealth, and it is also true that the defendant is entitled to the benefit of the doubt when it comes to statutory construction, and that her conduct must fall clearly and plainly within the statute in order to be subject to conviction. And so what I would like to point out, and getting to Judge Russell's question, is that the legislature had already recognized that a lease purchase agreement was a unique species of contractual or consumer agreement.
Did they recognize it was a unique species of consumer agreement, or did they recognize it was a specific type of lease?
Well, it may...
Obviously, that your biggest problem in arguing something called a lease purchase agreement, it's not a lease, is the first word in the phrase lease purchase agreement.
And the language in the statute in 18.2118 says written lease. And what I argue is, strictly construing that statute, what they mean by that is a mere lease, not a lease purchase agreement. And if the court were to adopt a functional interpretation of this, with respect to the conduct at hand, which is essentially akin to a larceny, and it's the nature of this statute, the distinction between a lease and a lease purchase is very relevant on that issue, because what a lease contemplates always is that the property, whatever it may be, is going to be returned to the lessor. In other words, the lessor maintains a residual interest in the property. So when you're divvying up that ownership bundle of sticks, they always retain that residual interest. And so, in looking at the statute, when someone secretes that property away, when they dispose of it, they conceal it, they take it out of the Commonwealth or some other conduct like that, the concern is, wow, yeah, this begins to look kind of like a larceny. The person didn't engage in a trespassory taking because they got it by agreement. But again, that conduct, when they're never supposed to return it, is more problematic than when you have a lease purchase where the consumer can become the buyer. They are always contemplating, and certainly with these cases, that's what it is. It's an installment purchase agreement.
Well, using the well-known property as a bundle of rights, at the time of the lease purchase agreement, doesn't Value City still have a residual interest in the property until the last payment is timely made?
Well, they try to have it both ways, which is why it ought to be distinguished in the statute.
Did Value City have a residual interest in the property until the last payment was made?
Yes, depending upon the consumer's choice about whether they chose to actually purchase the property or not.
So in month one, when she failed to make the first payment after the down payment, Value City was the owner of the property or had a residual ownership interest in the property?
Yes. Yes, that's true. But we're dealing with the facts there. What I'm suggesting is when we look at the statute and what is meant by a written lease, and I'm asking for a restrictive definition consistent with the cardinal principles of statutory construction that I've cited to the court, it's meaningful that those two types of agreements, a mere lease always contemplating residual ownership with the lessor and a lease purchase. And I would suggest to you, very few consumers really have an interest in a temporary lease period for furniture. I mean, there may be particular consumers that would have that use, but I can't imagine it would apply to many. So these are really set up as installment purchase agreements for people who might, for credit worthiness problems or some other...
Under this agreement?
Yes.
If, say, after 3 months she had had a financial hardship and returned the property, would that have ended her obligation?
Well, she would have, she still would have had additional monies to pay.
But she wouldn't have had to pay the full term.
She wouldn't have had to pay the full term. I believe it was cut off at 4 months, if I'm not mistaken. And again, that picks up with the statutory terminology. But again, even at the time that this conduct occurred, there was the Virginia legislature had recognized a unique species of agreements that were called lease purchase agreements. And if the court looks, that's relevant because it bears on what we look to in terms of the intent when someone merely stumbles and doesn't pay what they're supposed to under such an agreement. Turning then towards the second assignment of error, the Commonwealth has the burden to prove intent to defraud. That is, they have to show that there's some evil intent, some specific intent to deceive or trick. The only evidence that the Commonwealth offered in this case was that the fact that they had sent a letter to the debtor, and that was unquestioned, and then the property was not returned, the furniture was not returned. But no other evidence suggested that she maintained an intent to deceive or trick or had evil intent in her mind at all. This is someone who came into the store. She furnished accurate information in terms of her identity, her address, where she worked, how to get in touch with her, where the property was going to be. All of that was unrebutted. So there was no trickery whatsoever.
What about the fact that she understood the agreement and didn't pay toward the arrangement and kept the furniture?
Well, she paid the initial payment, which was nearly $400, and then gave unrebutted testimony as to unexpected financial distress that fell upon her. The same month that she...
But those are factual findings by the trial court, correct?
Well, the court didn't really analyze that. In fact, the court just said, well, you know, she kept the property for so long. And the court, in fact, found there was no fault at the beginning of this. What I fault you for is your conduct later, which I find is, which the court found was appropriate under the statute to look to her intent at a point in time later after the agreement.
How does the financial hardship prevent her from saying, I can't make the payment, come get it?
Well, this was not, mind you, a videotape or something that's easily taken back to the store. This is not a carpet cleaner.
Well, right, but she didn't call the store and say, I can't make the payment, come get it. I'm sure they've, I mean, that didn't happen.
I understand, but it's indicative of someone who intended to pay. If you look at the particulars of her situation.
How is it indicative of somebody willing to pay when she didn't make any payments after that initial?
Well, plausibly explained, though. She said, when she took the stand, she testified on her own behalf. She was unimpeached by prior record because she has no record of any criminal conviction at all. And she indicated to the court that she understood. I understand. I owe the money. I'm not disputing that. But I didn't defraud anyone. That was her testimony. And she pointed to exactly the timeline of what happened to her.
Isn't the provision of the statute that says that it's prima facie evidence of an intent to defraud when you don't return it after you have gotten the letter? Isn't that specifically for a situation where there may not have been an intent to defraud at the beginning, or it would be impossible to prove because the first payment was made, but then given months and months and months and multiple opportunities, including after she served with the felony warrant to arrange for it to be returned, and doesn't the fact that the General Assembly said that's prima facie evidence of an intent to defraud, isn't that enough for the Commonwealth to get there?
It's a prima facie case, but it's, of course, subject to rebuttal, and the Commonwealth always maintains the burden of proof on the element. Otherwise, it's not a constitutional statute.
But if the trier of fact doesn't believe her that she was always trying to return the property, then doesn't she lose?
Well, but there has to be a rational basis to reject her testimony. Again,
she's lying to conceal her guilt.
But this was unrebutted testimony. I mean, she had...
Well, rebutted by her conduct. I wanted to give the stuff back. Over 12 months, I never did.
Right, and again, the nature of the item tells you... And again, the particulars of the facts are helpful to Ms. Sharp because...
In the record, is there any indication that she made an attempt and couldn't because of her circumstances?
I don't think there's any indication in the record, but I mean, if the court thinks that negotiations weren't ongoing throughout this, I mean, I don't think that's a fair inference. I mean, it's not in the record. And I can tell the court, the problem is that if furniture is dinged up or damaged, they may not want it back to resolve the problem. But with respect to Ms. Sharp's particulars that are in the record, when she initiated the application, she had been a 10-year employee at Verizon. She was making over $50,000 a year. There was never any question that when she entered the obligation, she could pay for it. Her father died that month. She took a leave of absence from work, first at a reduced rate of pay, and then no pay at all. And then she had emergency surgery in the following months, was completely out of work, had another follow-up procedure that was associated with the initial surgery that she had, and she had just gotten back on her feet by the time of the trial. So, and her indication was she wanted to pay for it. She wanted to be the owner of that property, and she wanted to pay for it. And there was no evidence offered to suggest to the contrary. Again, she was not impeached by any prior record. She offered her testimony. She subjected herself to cross-examination. This was a debtor who simply fell on bad times and couldn't pay a debt. And if we apply the statute in the way the Commonwealth has asked, we're criminalizing what should be a civil case.
Counsel, you have a little over a minute if you want to save that for rebuttal.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Well, good morning. May it please the court, Aaron Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth. In response to the first assignment of error, Judge Russell has already touched upon it this morning. When the General Assembly amends a statute, we have to operate under the presumption that they have changed the law. So by actually removing lease purchase agreements from the sweep of the statute, we are left with the presumption that lease purchase agreements were actually a part of the statute at one time, at the time of the defendant's conduct, especially.
Counsel, that reading requires us to make a determination that it was clear in the statute, correct?
Before we apply the
before we apply the
presumption.
Not the presumption, but the principle that in statutory interpretation, the General Assembly did not mean to create something new versus clarifying. The difference between something new versus clarifying language.
That we have to make a determination that it was unclear.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And I would submit that it wasn't unclear.
You'd submit lease equals...
Equals a written lease agreement. It's just a type of lease. It operates as a regular lease with the exception of the last payment. That's the only difference between a lease purchase agreement and a, for lack of a better term, traditional lease, is that the last payment, the person ends up owning the property.
And is that consistent with the fact that there's a whole other statute that deals with these lease purchase agreements? Would that be consistent?
Yes, I would say it's consistent. I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, there's a whole other piece of law out there that deals with lease purchase agreements.
Right.
Which would, some would say, I think Mr. Ritter would say, that shows that it's a different kind of species as opposed to simply a lease.
Well, I would just submit that written lease is a pretty generic term. Even if it's a different type of species, I would still say it falls
under the
general
written
lease term. I would submit that it's not simply a clarification of existing law. I will tell the court that I did try. You know, we don't really have legislative history here in Virginia, and I tried to find something when they changed this that maybe would suggest that maybe they were just trying to clarify law or change law or whatnot, and I could not find anything. The only thing I did find was Delegate Albo, his statements when this there was a videotape of his statements in the General Assembly when they submitted this for a vote, and the only thing he talked about was another part of the bill where that deals with restitution. He didn't touch upon obviously this is not in the record, but he didn't touch upon this change in the lease purchase agreement. So I would submit that we're just left with this proposition that this amendment is a change in the law. And this court has held in previous cases, has upheld these types of agreements in previous cases. Moving on to the second assignment of error, we have to start with the statute itself, and there is a notice provision that was followed in this case. And under that notice provision, if the defendant did not return the property within, I think it is 30 days, then it's prima facie evidence of the intent of the fraud. So the Commonwealth gets to operate from that strength. And I would strongly disagree if there was no evidence to suggest that there was an intent of the fraud. All the evidence that the defendant relies upon is based on her own testimony, and the finder of fact is the finder of fact, and an intent is a factual determination, and the finder of fact is entitled to reject that. And that's what happened in this case, is the trier of fact was heard her testimony that she had just simply fell on hard times and determined that there was an intent to the fraud based on a number of circumstances, based on the fact that she only made one payment, no other payments, that she had promised the Rent-A-Center Value City that she was going to return this property or make a payment, and she repeatedly broke that promise, and also that she had kept up with other financial obligations but had not paid anything to the Rent-A-Center. As to the nature of the items, I think that she could have called and said, come pick it up. I think also that she could have rented a truck. That's not a very expensive thing to rent. That's, I think the Commonwealth asked her about that during the hearing. I guess if there are no other questions, I'd just ask that the court affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
On the issue of intent to defraud, again, we're talking about something that's the equivalent of a larceny. Imagine a thief who tells you their name, what items they're going to steal, where those items are going to be, where they work, what their address is, what their phone number is, all the means to subject themselves to prosecution. It doesn't make any sense. That's what this woman did.
Does that mean the only way you can get a conviction for under this statute is if the person lies in the lease?
Well, no, but you have to have some evidence to support that besides simply the fact that a letter was sent to her. The only thing the trial court did was fault her for keeping up with her other obligations, which the Commonwealth cites today. She paid her mortgage, but she was behind 3 months. She paid her car payment, was behind on that 3 months, was behind on her light bill. That was all unrebutted testimony. The idea that someone, and that reflects the natural priorities of a debtor in financial distress. You're not going to pay for home furniture if you're about to be homeless. If you're trying to maintain your employment, you're going to maintain your automobile so you can get to the job so that you can have the means to pay not only for that, but also for the home furniture. There was no intent to defraud. We'd ask the court to reverse.
Thank you, counsel. We'll come down.